Thanks, Carl. Hello. Good morning. You're very welcome to the programme. Between now and nine, the gentle art of persuasion in Offaly, finding a route through the poly crisis, swimming against the tide in Galway, and parading the red carpet in Cork. Let us start this morning with the RTE Countrywide House Band, recorded live this morning in one of their first performances this season. Why? Well, just because. Well, weren't they in fine fettle this morning? The week's sun on their feathers probably doing them good, as I hope it has you too, because we need to roll up the sleeves and get stuck into one of the thornier issues on the countrywide agenda. State facing €26 billion in fines for broken climate pledges. Environment correspondent Caroline O'Doherty's eye-popping story on the front of the Irish Independent this week. A big chunk of those fines could well come from not reducing emissions from the land. 4 million tonnes of greenhouse gases seeping out of drained farmland and turf-cut bog. And we are legally obliged to make significant cuts to that 4 million tonnes figure over the course of the next 5 years. And you do that by re-wetting. Not flooding, re-wetting, raising the water table from the bottom up by blocking drains. Even just 10 centimetres, excuse me, just 10 centimetres of higher water table reduces emissions significantly. But in many places, it will also make that land less farmable. The government has now embarked on trying to persuade farmers to voluntarily re-wet their land. Has not got a good reception so far. But, as I found out on the ground in the Midlands during the week, there will be some farms for which re-wetting would actually be a positive, and others for which it won't work at all.
It's a 74 hectares altogether, 10 rented, 64 owned.
Mark Lamb milks 80 cows on land beside Raheen Moore Bog in County Offaly.
Background running towards bog.
Yeah. How much would potentially be in the firing line for re-wetting?
Oh, you're talking 60% of my farm, so you're talking, you know, the guts of 100 acres, like, you know. If that was gone, I wouldn't be viable. You know, it wouldn't make sense anymore, you know.
He will probably be one of the people the Department of Agriculture is now going to try and entice into a voluntary re-wetting scheme. But it will take a lot of enticing.
So this is your career, your income, your asset. It's basically the sun, moon and stars.
More or less.
My wife
and my kids, Claire and Tomás and Kate as well, of course, very important. But that's the farm is, you know, second. You know, it's in the blood, you know. It's been here longer than me and it'll be here after me, hopefully.
So any voluntary scheme would have to be pretty attractive.
Well, hugely. And as I say, for me right now, and I don't see it changing anything soon, it wouldn't even be on my radar.
Mark feels that re-wetting would mean the land would support less cows, and Mark feels that he can't tinker with the ratio of cows to land too much before his farm would be pushed into being unviable. We went backwards and forwards with all different kinds of offers that the department could make him, but ultimately it came down to this.
I don't want to do it. I enjoy farming. That's what I do. This is my career. This is my earning potential. This is, you know, something my father and me have created. Why would I want to give that up? You know,
because the really difficult thing that's going to happen is 5 years down the line, taxpayer is going to be saying, hang on a second, why have we not got on top of these emissions? Where are they coming from? Oh, Mark Lamb's farm is one of the places where no progress towards reducing emissions has been made.
I think huge progress has been made. You know, as I said, we've taken on board the different ways of spreading slurry. We've reduced artificial fertiliser by 50% in this farm. No, we've changed the grass seed we're using. We're using multi-species sward. How much more can you walk on someone's neck? You know, they will eventually stop breeding, you know. Is that what you want? My responsibility is to take care of my cows, pay my bills, pay my mortgage, and take care of what I have. I am not responsible for that. I have done my fair share. I don't think taking half my farm off me is even an acceptable conversation.
You have done, as a farmer, more than I have as a non-farmer. I think that's true 100%. Nationally. Neither you nor I have done enough yet to get to grips with the situation.
Yeah, no, I'd agree. Look, there is more to be done. There's probably more can be done on the farm. But, like, taking the farm away from me, like, that's... Okay. Taking half... And, like...
That's the key question then here, really, isn't it? That if your farm is no longer economically viable, there's going to be no environmental initiatives taken here.
No. There'll be nothing to improve upon. There will be nothing here, you know? I don't think anyone's going to take this laying down, you know? This is a land grab. And we don't deserve that, you know? You know, look at the people with 4x4s collecting their kids from school. There's carbon, you know? Go and calculate the emissions at Dublin Airport. There's carbon. Take it out of the atmosphere. Don't ask us to take it out of the atmosphere. Don't put it up there. If you don't, if you can't deal with it, then don't put so much up there.
So it would need to be a very attractive package and a very well thought out message to persuade you to change what it is that you're doing.
Perhaps, look, maybe someone closer to retirement age, nobody coming on, I could... Completely, you could see it being an option for them.
But for a young man like you with a family, who enjoys doing what he's doing,
I do enjoy doing what I'm doing. And no, I'm not for turning.
So this drain originally was from here, 1, 2, 3, 4 meters
wide.
4 meters wide, and it was probably about 2 meters deep, and that started up there. And went the whole way down.
And all filled in now?
All filled in.
By way of complete contrast, on the other side of Offaly, right beside Clara Bog, Ian Sheridan has chosen to block the drains on his land and actively re-wet it, raising the water table to quite close to the surface of the field.
The water table has raised, yeah. Obviously it will raise to a certain point, but it's making no difference to my land.
The number of animals you can put out and the number of months that you can put them out and when you can put them out.
Basically, just be clever about it. Don't stick them out on wet days. If you have a wet week, you wouldn't put cattle down there. Neither would I. You'd take them out there.
Okay.
You know?
But when you've had a dry week, even with the water table raised to within, what, 30, 40 centimetres?
It's supposed to be 20 centimetres below the top of the ground.
20 centimetres?
Yeah.
That's all?
Yeah.
And you can still happily have your cattle coming out?
Oh, yeah.
On the drier days?
On the drier days.
When it hasn't been raining on top of that directly?
Yeah, pretty much, yeah.
That's just not what I had expected you to have said at all.
Yeah.
Did you expect that?
My father said at the time, this will make no difference to this land.
This being blocking the drains will make no difference.
He said it make no difference to it. And in fairness, he was right. It is no different.
Ian is farming a lot less animals than Mark, and the lie of his land is very different. Some parts black, buttery, peaty soil, and other parts of the same field a red, sandy soil badly in need of water.
Everything like this, it just dries up so quickly and so fast. As I say, especially around here, if you were here 10, 15, 20 years ago, all this ground would have been a lot wetter. A lot wetter.
But if this was to dry out, presumably then when the first shower of rain does come along, you're losing loads of soil into the river.
Yeah.
And is it even blown off in the wind?
Yeah, a lot of it is, yeah. It just dries out so quickly. When I receded all of that there and I came across here and receded this, everything just dried out to, like, into nothing, into dust.
And it needs to be wet.
It needs to be wet because that's just the way it is. It needs constant nearly water to keep this alive. If you go and if you have a nice, lovely, lovely brown clay, it will hold a certain amount of moisture, especially underneath. But this thing just washes it off.
Is the lesson from all of this, perhaps, suck it and see before you make your mind up about rewetting?
Yeah, I reckon so. I think if you had to have a look at other people, what they're doing, and see is there any similarities between your land and what he's doing or whatever like that? Yeah, definitely. It's. You know, but sometimes I think you just need to be bullish and a bit daring and give it a go.
Ian Sheridan persuaded, Mark Lamb less so. Both men in Offaly, thank you for their time this week. Now, I went to an IFA meeting in Athlone on Thursday night. Department of Agriculture officials at the top table trying to communicate their message that any re-wetting will be voluntary and that it could represent an opportunity, but they were facing several hundred sceptical farmers looking mostly unpersuaded. There was a lot of memories in the room of previous environmental initiatives that had delivered only obligations, regulations and extra work, but no financial support. So I thought that the best person in the best position to navigate a path through this thicket is Trinity College botanist Dr. Catherine Farrell. She understands the science of why the re-wetting has to happen, but she has also worked in the past to actually re-wet land without accidentally flooding neighbouring farmland.
So when I worked with Bordemona, we reviewed the 80,000 hectares that Bordemona has. We identified areas that could be re-wetted, and in many instances we raised the water table right up to the surface, and in some places working alongside with adjoining landowners who were concerned that this re-wetting or raising the water level might have an impact on their land, and finding the solution that worked for them as well.
So you didn't always sit in luxuriously appointed ivory towers. You have rolled up the sleeves and got the hands dirty. What have you learned about allaying landowner concerns around re-wetting?
Well, the first thing is to listen to them. So it's to go in and not tell them that, you know, this is what we're going to do. It's to go and walk the land with them and listen to his side, listen to or her side. But what's important is, you know, what we heard from the two great farmers that you had. We have Mark, and, you know, he has heard something from somebody and it's frightened him. But all of this work is voluntary, 100%. Nobody's going to take the land from him.
Why is this happening now? Why has the department set itself this task?
Well, we have to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions to comply with our climate action plan, our land use and land use change and forestry targets. So we have ambitious targets and we have to achieve them. 20% of our terrestrial land area is covered by peat soils. How we manage our peat soils is really important from a carbon perspective. We have to actually step up and start acting now on these targets.
This is where it gets diabolically complicated, though, because on the one hand, if these lands are not re-wet, the fines could end up forming a fairly significant proportion of that $26 billion estimated cost here. On the other hand, this is privately owned land. Nobody can be coerced into doing anything. They have to be actively persuaded into doing something. But on the other hand from that, it would be immoral, would it not, for the taxpayer to be offering a package of incentives that would be the equivalent of what they're earning from their dairy business right now, when there are so many other uses for those taxpayer euros elsewhere. It's a pretty knotty problem. Is there a solution?
It's knotty, and a farmer needs to be sure that by taking action today, I'm not shooting myself in the foot in the next 10 years, right? But also, I need to guarantee my income if I raise the water level. I want to have that guarantee for 30 years. So the term here would be, how do I de-risk what I'm going to do now, today? So combining the public finance, so that could be the cap payments, or it could be, you know, a climate action fund, like Bordemona got a climate action fund for their land, so that the farmers should be supported. And then what we have is we have a number of companies, and farmers fall within their value chain. So what that means is these companies are relying on these farmers, and those companies need to reduce the carbon emissions in their value chain. So it's in their interest to support Mark or Ian to reduce their carbon emissions.
So they can pay them to offset with a carbon credit. But the problem there is that these farmers, these landowners, are looking for guarantees for 30, 40 years down the line. And the value of carbon credits might go down just as much as they would go up. So you can't make them a promise, can you, that they are still going to be getting X number of euros a year in 40 years' time?
I think we have to, and we have to link it to the benefits that are also not just carbon. So it always frustrates me as someone who sees the holistic view. So when you manage your farm, you're managing it for your production, but it's not just about the gas that you can't see, it's the water quality, it's the soil quality, the soil structure, which helps if you've got a good soil. So all this week we've been talking about soil health at this summit, and that underpins good production. So if we can get our soils healthy, we can reduce the amount of nitrogen that we need to bring in, we can reduce inputs, we can get the same outputs, we can have climate resilience, we can have more nature, we can have more diverse flows of natural information around the place, but importantly, natural infrastructure that will help to absorb water in those big, massive showers that we're starting to see, that can help to hold on to the water in the big drought. So for me, this is about the farmer. There's a lot of talk. We have to start with the farmer, engage with the farmer, support them as much as possible from climate resilience, but business resilience. And this scaremongering is not helpful for anyone.
How much of an outlier do you think Ian Sheridan's farm is? Or might there be a considerable number of farms out there and land that would actually benefit from being re-wet?
I don't think Ian is an outlier at all. I think that he is one of many. I think he's the leader in this situation. And when I went to the Farm Peace End of Project Conference, there were farmers of all ages there, lots of farmers that were over 60. They were really enjoying being part of this story. So they felt involved and they were proud to be doing their bit for climate. And we learned so much from hearing their experience. And they were all different. But importantly, they were getting money. So they were getting paid, they were getting rewarded. But there's more to it. And Brendan Dunford always talks about, you know, the head, the heart and the pocket. And we have to address all of those elements. If the farmers aren't part of the conversation, we're not going to see the innovation that we need. The more that we have of including farmers in the conversation, farmers are the ultimate innovators.
So there is an opportunity here, rather than a cause for anxiety, which is the way that this is being cast at the moment.
So in my experience, when anybody is faced with change, there's an immediate anxiety. I've been doing this for as long as I've been around, for 20 or 30 years as a farmer, maybe in Mark's case. I grew up with Dad on the farm and he showed me what to do. But change, that man, his father, experienced a lot of change. So the change from the way we would have done it 40 years ago was quite dramatic to where we've got now, into a much more refined, almost monoculture type of system. So change is just part of navigating this climate action that we need to take, and climate action to ensure that there is, you know, a healthy planet for us all to be living in 20, 30 years, and for Mark's family.
And deal with it now rather than find ourselves in 2030 with taxpayers saying, why the hell didn't you do more back in 2025?
So I'm a taxpayer and I find it very frustrating to think that you could be spending my money now on action and not wasting a load of it in 5 years' time.
Dr. Catherine Farrell there. We're going to be discussing a little bit later on in the programme how we have actually started paying these fines already for missed 2020 targets. 100 million euro gone, paid out, not coming back. But I think we might bring the temperature down after the ad break by going swimming.
Email countrywide at rte.ie. Countrywide on RTE Radio 1.
As the weather gradually gets to the point that you might think about dipping a toe in the sea again sometime soon, use the example, perhaps, of County Kerry's Nuala Moor to shame you into getting on with taking the plunge. Nuala has swum around Ireland, swum across the Bering Straits between Alaska and Siberia. But when she met Lorna Siggins, she began by telling her about how she was the first person to navigate Cape Horn on the southernmost tip of South America by swimming across the meridian from the Atlantic to the Pacific Ocean. Her book, Limitless, tells her story, and she began by showing Lorna a photo in it of her raising the RNLI flag at Cape Horn Island Lighthouse.
The photograph that we're looking at in the book is the moment that I actually climbed up onto the island of Cape Horn in Cabo de Hornos, and it's 100 nautical miles south of the most southerly tip of South America. I suppose looking here even on Barna Pier as we head west, you know, you're thousands of miles of rolling ocean. So down there it's similar. You've got the Pacific, the Atlantic and the Antarctic oceans meeting. And just south of Cape Horn, at that point of 56 degrees south, there's no land east or west as the world turns. The swim that I had chosen to do was the meeting of the oceans, where the swimmer, me, got into the water in the Pacific and crossed the meridian into the Atlantic. When you have freedom of oceans, you have rogue waves, you have shelves, you have 4 kilometres deep of water. And when I did cross the meridian, I was picked up by my boat and climbing up onto the island to leave my tricolour with the Admiral was an amazing, amazing opportunity, yeah. My father used to always say to me, you know, you were built for this. And, you know, I would think, would you stop just calling me that? But actually, when we're told that we're built for something, you draw upon who you are as a person. And I used to have this mantra that would go around in my head. And whenever things got tough and things got very difficult and I couldn't navigate through some water, I would always say, this is why you're here, whatever that means. And it wasn't to quit. You look up at Cape Horn, and the same when I swam Russia to America with the relay team. It's a privilege to be this strong. My father always would say that, you know, no storm can hit you on four sides, so keep rotating and find your calm. So in your book, you talk about community. I think when you are in swims like when we swam around Ireland in 2006, it's hard to believe it's 19 years ago, but, you know, people don't ever, I suppose, look at the team that happens behind the doors at night. When we would come in from swims, we would unload our boxes or try and wash our gear. Down the hall, you had Brendan and Derek, and they would be looking over maps, trying to figure out a way to get you there, because pilots and boats, they work all the time to try and figure out routes. A team is vital. A lot of times, and I think sometimes we forget as swimmers, that we can't see, hear or speak in a lot of environments. You can't shout, you can't scream, you can't assess a risk that can only be seen by a team.
And you take from what people said to you, like your father, like Pat Connor?
There was a beautiful quote given to me from Pat Connor Balagaw. It was something I think that resonates with a lot of coastal communities, and it is, Ní curann ariga ahanair é na riamh, más é de céad lá é ná de vílo lá, má thugann tú seanstaí tógadh síthú, ní le dromhain ach sin é dhéanann sí. And it's that the sea doesn't make friends with anybody, and if you give her a chance, it doesn't matter if it's your first day or your thousandth day, she will take you. And it's not out of bad. It's just what she does. So, you know, growing up as a child, like, we were told what to look for. We were told, don't ever take your eye off it. And I always had this thing that extremes keep you honest, and in the knowledge that respect is vital in and around the sea.
So what is going through your mind?
In Cape Horn, I found it very difficult because I kept thinking, this is crazy. I have to be home for work on Monday. What if they lose me? And it was the first time that I was faced with the statement that if they lose sight of me, I won't make land. And then I felt a huge burden I had placed on my team because of the risk I was taking. And then, you know, there are certain points in your swim where if you don't stay 100%, the burden then shifts to the challenge they're facing. So I just felt the best thing I could do was sing a song. So I had to get my rhythm and my breathing. And the beautiful thing about the sea is you have to find a rhythm. And sometimes it's a slow waltz, and sometimes it's a tango, and sometimes it's a rap. You know, it depends on which way the waves are coming. Cape Horn was chaos. It was like a rave. And I just couldn't find a rhythm, but I thought Christy Moore would bring me back, you know. And it was around by Terra del Fuego and up the Wormgove Stream and into Dingle for the night. So, you know, a boat sailed out of Brandon and started. But I remember looking up at Cape Horn and 4 albatross came above my head. And I just thought the size of them, and it reminded me of the gannets coming down and swooping. And I thought, what if they work together? What if 4 of them decide, here comes lunch, and I am suddenly last seen being carried over Cape Horn? The things that go through your head. You know, I looked up at Cape Horn and I thought that 2 days previous, the Volvo Ocean Race passed south. And I thought, how privileged I am. Like, who gets these moments? Who has these moments that you were strong enough to be who you want to be?
And in your book, which you dedicate to your sister, Mary, you write about having been in the Coast Guard. You write about having been rescued yourself. So you are very aware all the time of safety and having a plan.
And I think so. Plan your swim, swim your plan. And a lot of people were saying, you know, oh gosh, it, you know, you were rescued. Being rescued was, that was the last part of the plan. So you bring a safety plan to its end, and the end is that you have to call for help. You know, when I look at 6 and 5 and 4 people and they say we swim in a group, I think it's really important that the group know what a rescue looks like. And I'm always saying that to people, it's a great team building exercise if you try and get each other to shore. It's a very good manhandling exercise of laughter. So interestingly enough, I would say to people, if you've got 2 and 3 people together or 4 people, that you simulate somebody getting into difficulty some morning. Instead of just swimming point A to point B, say, okay, today you're going to be a casualty, so what are we going to do about it? And what does that look like in the group? And I think that's a great team building exercise, because you'll see how difficult it is, because preparation is key. And it may mean that somebody takes it upon themselves in their car to have a little blanket some morning, that somebody has a little grab bag, that everybody knows everybody's phone numbers, that you pack your bag reverse. The other one that I would often talk about is that when you get dressed after coming out of cold water, your inner layer poultices out the cold. So, you know, within about an hour or so, I would always change my inner layers. It takes about an hour to move your body up a degree. So obviously it takes about 3 to 4 hours for the body to recover. Understanding your swim, understanding the challenge, knowing who you are as a swimmer, you know, so I think it's about boxing clever.
Particularly at this time of year, it's the coldest time of year.
Yeah, sure. Well, I just think, you know, we're not designed to be in cold water. Our bodies are not designed to be in there, and it's not if the cold will impact you, it's when.
Christy Moore, not just useful for getting you home on a long, lonely road late at night, but also getting you around Cape Horn. Nuala's book is published by Gill Books. It's called Limitless. She was obviously talking to our Lorna Siggins. Now, I do not want to ruin your Saturday morning by itemising just how complicated the world has gotten recently, so I'm going to use the new acceptable shorthand to describe our current situation, the polycrisis. A roadmap through the polycrisis for food producers and for farmers would be very handy. So when we heard this week that Professor Alan Matthews was going to be back in Ireland, we asked him very nicely for an interview, because Alan is Professor Emeritus of Agricultural Economy in TCD, and of all of Countrywide's contributors, he's the one with the best record for accurate predictions. So when we sat down yesterday, he had a bit of a rude awakening for anyone predicting that Irish farmers might do well in negotiations over the next CAP.
I think the key impact is going to be on the upcoming negotiations around the EU long-term budget, which will be starting later this year. We know that around a third of that budget is allocated to CAP spending, and that's hugely important to Ireland and to Irish farmers. There's going to be a huge squeeze on the priorities for European spending in that coming period, partly to do with the defence and security build-up, but there's also issues around border protection, migration issues.
All of which means anybody who is lobbying for or hoping for an increased common agricultural policy spend is probably barking up the wrong tree.
You know, it's clearly going to be extraordinarily difficult even to maintain the existing budget, let alone look to an increase, which many people would argue would be justified, because clearly inflation has eroded the real value of that spending over the last number of years. That's going to mean that we're going to have to look at really ensuring we get value for how we spend the money that we receive under the CAP budget. Are we making the best use of it even at the present time? And can we try to get more value per euro if indeed funding is cut in the coming period?
If there is no additional money, all of these other add-ons, like a nature restoration law, doing a better job at meeting our emissions targets, there's no clear funding path for any of this, is there?
We've been talking about European funding. Of course, national funding is important, and the government has allocated funding out of the new National Infrastructure and Climate Fund to support initiatives also in the agricultural sector. I think the precise figures are not yet known, but there is a commitment there. So, you know, potentially we can look at national funding. We are, to some extent, rather unique in Europe. We have a relatively strong fiscal position. Most other European countries are really struggling to fund deficits. So we should also look to that national funding stream. And of course, the third potential funding stream is from consumers themselves, to the extent to which consumers, both at home but also our export market customers, are prepared to pay for the sustainability credentials of Irish food.
What do you think is going to happen on the nitrates derogation?
I'm not going to predict whether we will succeed in achieving the. I mean, there's a very specific target that we have to meet next year. And if we don't meet it, then clearly we're not going to get an extension.
It's a two-part question. There's the science element on which we're failing because we're not improving our standards. But then there's the political element. And do you think that the tone, the tenor, the aspirations of this new commission have changed sufficiently since the last one to open the door to the possibility of a deal being done? Because the byword, the watchword of this new commission is competition.
I can see that argument, but I think we need to recognise that the derogation is approved by the member states as such. It's a common decision by member states. All other member states are now subject to the full impact of the nitrates directive. So looking for special treatment for Ireland is going to be a hard call, despite the argument you're making that the Commission might be less reluctant to be strict, if you like, about implementation of the rules.
Who knows what's going to happen on April 2nd when President Trump makes his tariffs announcement? How exposed is Irish agriculture to tariffs?
Well, we're not so exposed to tariffs on US imports. A fun fact here for you, Philip, is that if you extend our definition of agricultural and food exports, by far our largest export to the US is aromatics and so on, essential oils. We actually export almost 4 billion euro, would you believe, to the US?
No way, really?
Yeah, which is way ahead of our spirits and drinks, which is just under a billion, and our dairy exports about 600 million.
So there's more money in lavender than there is in milk exports to America.
Just if you look at the revenue, the export value figures, that clearly the value added is much smaller because we're probably importing quite a lot of the ingredients for that, but seems to be an unsung success story. But the key markets where we are exposed is dairy, particularly on the butter side with Kerrygold, and also then of course spirits, so the Irish whiskies, cream liqueurs and so on. But we're not so exposed to the US market as such. I think that many of the impacts will be indirect. So if the US tariffs lead to, for example, a contraction generally across our European markets in terms of consumer spending, that knock-on effect may be more important in terms of reducing demand for Irish food products than the direct impact of the tariffs on US imports.
Possible trade war, an actual war, worsening or deepening environmental crises. Has Europe's institutions got the political capital, the dynamism at the moment? Are they functioning well enough, do you think, to deal with all of these polycrises happening simultaneously?
This is absolutely the fundamental question, I think. The argument is often made that Europe has faced crises in the past and that we have risen to address these crises. I guess the COVID pandemic would be an example of the most recent one. But I think it's a little bit optimistic to suggest that simply because we've done this in the past, that this means that it's inevitable we're going to do it in the future. And clearly there are weaknesses. Relatively few governments across the European Union that are firmly in power, particularly in terms of the bigger countries. We see decision-making, particularly around defence issues in the European Union, made more difficult because there's clear disagreements, particularly with Hungary and Slovakia, who are, in a sense, imposing a veto, so that unanimity rule it makes progress very difficult. So one must be a little bit concerned that perhaps Europe is not going to react fast enough. Maybe we can take the decisions, but whether we can do it at the speed with which the geopolitical context requires, I think is an open question.
Front page headline in the Irish Independent this week brought into very sharp focus once again the possible bill for not meeting our emissions targets. Agriculture seems to be further than ever away from meeting its 25% target, currently only at 3%, and may only actually get to 1% of that target by 2030. Why is that?
First of all, we've seen progress in the non-agricultural sectors because technologies are available. So whether it's renewable energy in the energy sector or heat pumps in terms of home heating or electric vehicles in terms of transport. So we need to invest a lot more in trying to come up with technologies that we can make available to farmers to help them to reduce emissions. So that's one. And there's also, of course, a whole range of farm practices that we need to incentivize. And that's really the second point, that I'm not sure we've sufficiently incentivized farmers to actually make the necessary changes. We've relied heavily on voluntary enrollment in eco-schemes and in agri-environment schemes, the ACRES scheme. It's quite right that we should reward farmers for making the right moves, but I think we also probably need a little bit more of a regulatory approach in addition. The issue of fines that you raise, I mean, the issue there is, does it not make more sense to use that money, which may well be an outflow from the economy as a whole by 2030, to use that funding to actually incentivize the changes and to reduce emissions, you know, at home.
Spend a euro now to save 10, five years from now.
This is the argument. I mean, it's clear that from, if you look at the public finances, that money is not, it's not a pot of money that is there at the moment, but it is potentially money which the government at the time is going to have to find to purchase these credits from Europe. So why not spend the money now?
There appears to be a political calculation, indeed a social calculation, around fines arising from not meeting targets. Asher, we can do a deal. We can wriggle out of that somehow. We are, aren't we, paying fines now for having failed to meet our 2020 targets?
That's absolutely correct. We already spent almost 100 million because we weren't meeting our 2020 targets.
And that is money we have spent. It's not owed. It has actually been handed over.
Indeed, indeed.
Professor Frank O'Mara from Chagask on the programme recently was very optimistic about achieving the 25% target through innovation and efficiencies without having to have a voluntary exit programme or an incentivised cull of animals. Do you see a way of getting to 25% reductions over 2018 levels by 2030 without having to reduce the number of animals?
Looking at reducing the number of animals is maybe putting the cart before the horse. We need innovation and technical solutions that farmers can adopt. We need changes in farm practices because we're not only addressing a climate crisis, but also a biodiversity crisis, a water crisis. So we need to actually think holistically in terms of the types of farming practice. We need more trees in the landscape. We need more carbon in our soils and so on. So there's a range of issues that we need to address. But we also need to provide, you know, opportunities for farmers, and that's in the bioeconomy broadly. The issue here is creating a market for farmers. You know, without a market, farmers are not going to respond. They're not going to move into producing the relevant feedstocks for the bioeconomy. And I think there could be a role here for the state, you know, to actually provide some guarantees, whether it's providing some kind of minimum price guarantee that would encourage farmers. So it's not a question of, you know, saying to farmers, you've got to reduce your livestock numbers. It's a question of saying to farmers, look, much of your livestock farming is not very profitable at the present time. Here's an opportunity that we can provide to you to actually rethink your farming system, contribute to lower emissions, contribute to a more circular economy, and earn more income at the same time.
I don't want to put words in your mouth, but could you sum that up by saying nobody likes change, but there are opportunities here arising from these changes?
Absolutely. And we need, I think, to focus on those opportunities. We need to communicate to farmers that these are available. But as I say, there are things that the government can do, I think, to make these more tangible for farmers. As I say, we need to show that there is a market there. We need to give confidence to farmers that if they invest in, you know, new machinery, in learning about these new practices, that they're not going to be left high and dry in 5 years' time.
Professor Alan Matthews, €100 million in fines, it kind of puts all of the other spending stories into a different context, doesn't it? Well, it is awards season right now, as you know. We've had the IFTAs, we've had the BAFTAs, the Golden Globes and the Oscars. But tonight, the red carpet will be rolled out in North Cork for the Kildorrery GAA Film Awards. Local enthusiasts have created versions of 7 popular movies for tonight's gala screening and awards ceremony. In doing this, they have raised more than €80,000 for their local GAA AstroTurf pitch. They have reinforced also the ties that make the village such a great place to live, and they have found some great actors in their community, as Brenda Donoghue discovered.
No, it's my field. I dug the rocks out of it with my bare hands and made a living thing of it. My only wealth is that green grass, and you want to take it from me. Well, here in the sight of God, I can't let you do that.
Kevin Gallagher, Bull McCabe in the field, you're hoping to win the Best Actor Award, is that right?
Initially, I thought I was only coming up just to something in the background, but I get offered this position of doing the Bull. So I started growing a beard, and started getting serious about the thing. I didn't even recognise myself. My kids only knew who I was. But we had great fun doing the field, and tonight will be great because we'll see it all on television for the first time. So that should be very good.
Dennis, you're involved. What part are you playing?
Oh, I'm the auctioneer. I'm actually selling the field.
Like, the Bull McCabe is kind of in every part of the country. Fellas that farm the farms have the bit of the Bull McCabe in all of them. And you know, it was written in the 50s, but it was based in the 30s, but it could be today, because people at farm the land are linked to that. I think that's the thing I got out of doing the field anyway, you know.
Talk to me about this community here.
Well, I was born and reared here. My father was, his father, and his father is like...
Is the field. Is that line out of the field?
No. This actually is... You never see a village like it, the way everyone bands together, comes together, pulls together.
Now, whether we win any awards in the field, it doesn't matter. Our award was being involved in this whole project.
Good luck.
Thank you.
I've high hopes for you, Kevin.
Thank you, Brenda.
Have you ever been up to Kildare? Indeed, if you haven't, it's queer. Sure, it's only 5 miles from our Patrick, and 3 from the Cross of Red Chair. And when at the cross you were landed, you see a big hill looking down. On top of that hill, bare naked and chill, stands famous Kildare Town.
My name is Tracy McNamara, and my role is Kay, the mother in The Snapper. I'm originally from North Tipperary, a place called Bursley. My husband is from a place called Labashida in Clare. So we went on Google Maps, looked at the kind of a halfway point between... I was working in Macroom at the time, and my husband was working in Clonmel. So we went on Google Maps, and we found kind of North Cork might be our area. But we came to Kildare, and straight away, instantly, I think, we got a sense of the village. It was spotlessly clean. It was beautiful flowers, really well looked after. So we decided the best way to do the research was to visit the local establishments. So we met a very nice man by the name of Seamus Sheehan. I wanted to know why Tipperary team was on the wall, 2001 winning Tipperary team. And he said he had nephews called the Enrights that were on the team. And coincidentally, my own first cousin, Tommy Dunn, captained that team. So I straight away felt at home. Crossed over then to Welch's pub at the time. I met Tom and Noreen. Instantly reminded me of home. I was reared in a pub. And I said to my husband, OK, I think we might have found the place we'd like to live. Kildare is very much our home now.
Yeah. And when you say that, it's kind of emotional, really, isn't it? Because
totally.
It's everything, isn't it?
Totally. Yeah. Like, I suppose when you're born and bred somewhere, you always think of that as home. But for me now... I would definitely think of Kildare as my home. I would say I'm coming home, meaning I'm coming home to Kildare. And I never, ever thought I would say that about anywhere other than Bursley, where I was reared. So it is emotional. The way the community come together here is something spectacular. You'd actually have to see it to believe it. And I suppose this journey on the Film Awards is testament to that, but in a positive way. It's normally we come together when there's tragedy. And we all know that, and I've seen that. But when we come together in a positive way, so since the 28th of December, we have been socialising, literally socialising, and we have had such fun.
If you give half as good a performance at the Snapper, you're in with a shout there.
Well, actually, I'm a little bit worried about that performance because part of my role as Kay in the Snapper is I have to slap a local lady, Rita Keating, straight across the face. And I'm very nervous about that.
Yeah. Thank you very much. Best of luck. Minnie, get away from the window. If they see you.
They're hurting people, Ma. We just can't hide.
We're not part of the fight, Minnie. We need to keep our heads down. If they see you looking...
Trouble found us, Ma. It's everywhere.
Who've we got here?
Siobhan O'Reilly.
Eileen Harrington.
We're in a movie called The Resistance, which is an adaptation of The Rebellion that was showed on RTE1 a good few years ago.
Okay. Based on De Valera and Michael Collins.
So, and how are you finding it?
It's been brilliant. We've had the best fun. For a heavy movie, it's been the best fun.
We started with a blank canvas. So they handed us the script with no props, no prompts, no nothing. So we had to go away. We did the most amazing research. And we've learned so much about our Irish history that we probably should have known in school. But we know all about it now. So part of it wasn't even trying to find props. We had to turn up with guns for our ambush. And the guns were... we were saying, where are we going to get guns? One of our friends was inside in a shop talking to a guy getting other costumes. And he goes, I've guns. We said, how could you have guns?
Real guns?
I said, decommissioned the real, you know, the replicas of these guns. He said, he studied all this and he collects all these items. And he said, do you want them? We goes, yeah, come on. So he arrived up with the guns and he came. And after he put his guns on the table, he became the British soldier.
Basically, if you walk by, you get a part.
Oh, absolutely. You never know who you'll find or what you'll get in a charity shop.
I have a funny feeling you're going to win Best Ensemble Performance. What do you think?
Oh, sure, listen, we're all out for it. Like.
We're
all guns blazing, as we say.
Oscar night in Kildare. 80,000 raised for the AstroTurf pitch. That's impressive. Brenda Donoghue probably heading back down the M8 as we speak to see if they have an Oscar for her. That is it from us for this week. Paul Murnoch rolled out the red carpet. Amandine Paso-Devine wore Gucci. Harry Buklas wore Armani. Eileen Herron cut the acceptance speeches after 30 seconds. We will finish this morning as we started with the Countrywide House Band. Why? Just because. Have a good weekend, folks.
Countrywide on RTE Radio 1. Listen back on the RTE Radio Player.